I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Like a lot of you, I was introduced to the country's national parks as a kid. My family took a train west and we spent a week exploring Glacier National Park. When my son was little, we took him west several times to Glacier, Yellowstone, the Grand Tetons, Arches, Canyonlands, Mesa Verde, all memorable, even life-changing trips. The National Park Service turns 100 tomorrow and currently manages the country's many parks, monuments, battlefields, and historic sites that are truly national treasures. We are marking that anniversary today on Radio Times. We asked David Quammen to join us. He spent 2 years following grizzly bears in Yellowstone to see how wildlife survives in that ecosystem. He wrote about it for the May issue of National Geographic. It's now a book called Yellowstone, A Journey Through America's Wild Heart. And he joined us from Peak Recording Studio in Bozeman, Montana. And David Quammen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Nice to talk with you again.
Nice to talk with you as well. And also with us is Beth Pratt Bergstrom. She's California Director for the National Wildlife Federation. Spent about 25 years of her environmental career in two of the largest national parks, Yosemite and Yellowstone. She's got a book called When Mountain Lions Are Neighbors. And Beth Pratt Bergstrom, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome.
National parks.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Can't think of a better topic.
Exactly. And we will dig deep. David, let me begin with you. Wallace Stegner called the National Park Service or system America's best idea. Do you agree?
Well, he actually said the best idea we ever had. And then Ken Burns and Dayton Duncan morphed that into America's best idea for TV series. Yeah. I quibble with that. With all due respect to those three gentlemen, I quibble with that a little bit. We've had some other pretty good ideas in America, like constitutional democracy and a number of other things in the Declaration of Independence. I think of it as a good idea that has gotten better and a big idea that has gotten bigger. The idea of national parks, beginning with Yellowstone, the first national park back in 1872, has evolved over the decades and over the, more than a century. And in evolving, it has become a great, great idea. But it began as a much smaller and more pragmatic idea, tourism for the Northern Pacific Railroad coming to Yellowstone.
And I do want to pick up on all of that. Beth, let me get you in on the conversation. And I don't want to have a competition here, but I know that you love and have told us that Yosemite is your favorite place on Earth. Why is that?
You know, there's so many reasons for it. But I think, you know, for most of us who visit the parks, I think it's our response to the landscape. And, you know, even though it's my favorite, I wouldn't, you know, deem to say it's favorites for others. But for me, the response to the grand granite, the water, just the peacefulness of the landscape that I think you can throw your soul into. Once I saw it at age 21, my first visit, I was in the valley with it snow covered. There wasn't many people there. A coyote ran across, and those granite peaks with the water flowing down, I knew I was home.
And David, let me pick up on something you said about the early days of the national park system or service, even going back 100 years. What was the idea when Woodrow Wilson signed the act?
Well, it was realized after decades of sort of back and forth negative experience in Yellowstone that we needed a cadre, a service of professional park managers, wardens and rangers and people to take care of this place. Yellowstone had been established in 1872, but there was no National Park Service then. There was a lot of poaching that happened in Yellowstone for commercial hunting, for meat, for elk and other things. The park was really sorely abused for a number of years. And then in 1886, the Army was sent in. So the Army was running and protecting Yellowstone Park from 1886 until the National Park Service was established to take over for them.
And why did they need the military?
Well, they needed the military because armed poachers were coming in and out, killing elk, killing bison, vandalizing things. The military was there, and General Phil Sheridan, who had been a general under Grant during the Civil War and then had been a notorious, ferocious Indian fighter during the tragic wars against the Plains Indians, he came to Yellowstone in the early 1880s and to say something on behalf of Phil Sheridan. He saw that this place was being abused, and he said, we've got to do something about this. And the Secretary of the Interior then asked the Army to come in and protect the place.
Would Woodrow Wilson be proud and pleased about our park system today?
I certainly think he would. I think he would be. I think Ulysses Grant would be. Teddy Roosevelt would certainly be. Our park system needs a number of things, including more support and more funding, but it's a magnificent system.
Beth, let me go back to you. And according to the National Park Service, something like 300 million people visited, whether it was a park or a national monument or a historic site. Or a couple years ago, I went to Gettysburg, didn't realize that was part of the national park system. But is there a question, and I guess this always gets asked when asked about the national park system, whether it gets loved to death, whether we are preserving what needs to be preserved while enjoying all that parks have to offer?
Yeah. First, let me just touch on something David said, which is our early protectors, which I think there's just such a phenomenal history there. And in Yosemite, we had the military, but we also had the Buffalo Soldiers, which were the first African-American Army soldiers who helped protect the park in about 1899. They actually, their hats are what inspired some of the, you know, National Park Service flat hats that we all love today. So I think that's just such a great story to, you know, how the National Park Service evolved, that we have this African-American regiment that was such a vital part of the history. But yeah, you know, I grapple with that. I have to admit, I've been going to parks, you know, like you, Marty, who visited them in the summers, you know, with family. Mine were more Massachusetts growing up, but came to the Western parks as an adult. In Yosemite, there's no doubt. I've lived up there for 20 years. And when I came up, there was about 3.5 million visiting. And we're about up to record 4.5 million this year. And there's no doubt you can see a difference. You can see a difference in traffic. You can see a difference in some people on the landscape. I do think it's a good problem, but it is one we have to look at how to manage because it is a resource, and we want people to enjoy it. And if people don't enjoy it, they won't protect it. But there's also that really tough balance in protecting the resource for future generations. I used to live outside. I used to live in Yellowstone, and the arch was visible, the famous Roosevelt arch from my house, which has that inscription for the benefit and enjoyment of the people. But that also comes with preserving that resource. And it is a tough one, and I think it's a good problem, but it is a problem we have to address to make sure that we are protecting these parks, even with this increased visitation, which from what I'm understanding, I was just in the Rocky Mountains at the National Wildlife Federation annual meeting. It's across a lot of parks. Rocky Mountain is up about 1 million visitors a year as well.
Wow. And of course, this anniversary, I'm sure, has inspired a lot of people to get to the parks. But David, you spent a couple of years at Yellowstone following grizzlies, you know, following all the activity in that park. Is this a good problem to have? And can we solve this good problem?
Well, as Beth says, it is a good problem. The alternative is not enough support, not enough interest in U.S. national parks, and that's certainly not the problem. I've heard from people in Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks, including the superintendents, Dan Wenk at Yellowstone, David Vella at Grand Teton, that they're concerned about this, that they're trying to deal with this. They know this will be politically difficult to deal with when it comes to the point where you might have to say to the American public and people who love these parks, you might have to say, well, welcome to Yellowstone, park your car over there in the lot and get on the shuttle. Or you might even have to say, Yellowstone is temporarily full. Come back tomorrow. Now, that's not happening yet, but that's the sort of thing that is being contemplated by the managers. Yellowstone now is up over, I think, 4 million visitors last year.
Is it because of the number of people or just the way that the people travel the parks, David?
It's the number of people, the number of private automobiles, and the way people use the parks. There are a lot of international visitors coming now to the parks, and some of them have different customs, different habits, and that requires some adjustment. There may be signs in Chinese soon in Yellowstone telling people, you know, stay away from the bison for your own sake and for them. Don't feed the bears, you know. Respect the wildlife. So there's a problem with people management and vehicle management.
Beth, let me go back to you. And just from my experiences in parks, there are, of course, those popular places where most people go. But I was always surprised that how quickly you could, in a sense, get off the beaten path. It didn't take but 10 minutes or so to find yourself almost alone in a park. Should we think differently about how we explore and use these parks?
I think that's part of it. And I think, you know, David's on the right track and something that I think is probably the future, which is that, you know, there may be, like we're used to in everything, you know, you go to Disney World, it's a ticketed experience. But there are, you know, the number of people coming into the park, managing that, how they use it, the education, what is it like to be in visiting a park, you know, so that you don't drive on sensitive meadows or pick up wildlife.
Right.
But there are parks that are doing limited access successfully. And as David mentioned, like, you know, you park your car and you get in the bus, like Denali and Zion. So I think that is the model we need to look to. Also, like you said, how people use the park. In Yosemite, you know, 90%, it's not the exact stat, but most of the people congregate in Yosemite Valley, which is just 7 miles of, you know, 1,200 square miles of the park. When I hike in Yosemite, I go off trail a lot. I explore. Even on a busy summer day, I can't do anything about the traffic to get to where I'm hiking, but I don't see people. So, but recognizing that, though, most people aren't going to want to do that. So I do think we have to come up with a way. I mean, the fact of the matter is, in these parks, Old Faithful is always going to be the place in Yellowstone where the majority of the people want to see. And Yosemite, people, you know, they're not going to want to come to the park without a Yosemite Valley. So right. I think we do need to move towards solutions that manage those experiences well, whether it be limiting access on some days or, you know, flow of parking or shuttling people in. I don't know what the answer is, but I think, you know, David's on the right track. We have to look at those.
Well, we've been talking about two of the very popular parks, Yosemite and Yellowstone. But, David, I'm sure there are parks across the country that get very few visitors, and perhaps we should move them up on the list of places to visit.
Well, that's certainly a good idea. I mean, Marty, you mentioned Glacier.
Yes.
Glacier is up in the northwestern corner of Montana, and I'm sure that there's no shortage of visitors there, but most of the people who come west, like my family did in 1960, we had a similar experience. We drove out from Cincinnati and went to Yellowstone, and Glacier is a little bit off the beaten track for that, and some more people could get up to Glacier, a magnificent park, get there while the glaciers are still there. That's another issue, another problem, of course, how climate change is affecting some of these parks. But yeah, there are hundreds of wonderful national parks that almost nobody has ever heard of. And I think your next guest, Jeremy, probably can tell us about some of the more obscure parks that deserve to be much, much less obscure.
Well, in fact, Jeremy will be joining us in about 10 minutes. He visited something like 45 of the 47 parks in the lower 48. That's David Quammen. He's a well-known science writer. He's got a new book called Yellowstone, A Journey Through America's Wild Heart. Beth Pratt Bergstrom is with us as well, California director for the National Wildlife Federation. She wrote a book called When Mountain Lions Are Neighbors, and we are celebrating just a day early the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. 1-888-477-9499. That's the number to join the conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tell us about the national parks that you have enjoyed. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Beth Pratt Bergstrom and David Quammen about the nation's National Park Service, the many national parks across the country. And let me quote something, David, that you wrote in your piece. It was for National Geographic, and now it's a book. You write, Yellowstone is a big national park. The greater Yellowstone ecosystem is bigger still, but the ideas and values that these places represent, the decisions and commitments they demand, are as big as America itself. Help us understand the greater Yellowstone ecosystem.
Right. Well, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem is the largest area of wildish landscape within the heartland of America, within the lower 48 states. And it encompasses not just Yellowstone National Park and Grand Teton National Park, but also portions of a number of national forests, Bureau of Land Management lands, a bit of the Wind River Indian Reservation, and private lands. So that whereas Yellowstone is just a little bit over 2 million acres, Yellowstone Park, the greater Yellowstone ecosystem is 10 times that size. It's up around 22 million acres. And it's very important to remember that without the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, we wouldn't have healthy populations of elk and bison and grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park or in Grand Teton, because as big as those parks are, they're not big enough to entirely support populations of those species through the 12 months of the year at high elevations. The elk, for instance, migrate down off the Yellowstone Plateau onto big private ranches during the winter months. And so those ranches and the other private lands, as well as other public lands, are crucial parts of the connectivity of life in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem.
But doesn't that lead to conflicts over land? I mean, the wildlife probably see the land a lot differently than human beings do.
It does indeed, yeah. It's very complicated, very thorny, some of these issues. For instance, when bison migrate out of Yellowstone National Park into the state of Montana, they are not considered wildlife. They are considered livestock, managed by the Montana Department of Agriculture. And they're not welcome in the state of Montana because some of them carry a disease called brucellosis, which was brought in originally by European cattle, and it's considered possible that they might transmit that disease to the healthy populations of cattle, commercial livestock in the state of Montana. Transmission from bison to a cow has never been proven. Elk carry the disease as well. So there are paradoxes and inconsistencies in this whole thing, but that's just one among many issues that are complicated because of the multi-jurisdictional nature of this ecosystem.
Beth, let me get you to comment on that. As you mentioned, you lived in Yellowstone. Your book is also titled When Mountain Lions Are Neighbors, and it's about when wildlife moves into our neighborhood. Help us understand, I guess, the tension here, but also the potential benefits.
Yeah, you know, David's right. I actually lived right in Yellowstone, and I was on the border of the gateway community of Gardner, and it was really tough. So the bison literally, once they walked out of my backyard, they were changed from a protected, iconic animal to an animal that was managed very differently. And so I think there is this interesting, you know, we have tended for most of our life, and what I read about in my book, to think of we have these islands of habitat like national parks, which are vitally important that we put the wildlife in, and they're okay. But that's actually not what science is showing us. As David mentioned, like the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, they need corridors. They don't just stay in parks. You know, bison and other wildlife like wolves, they don't know park boundaries, right?
Right.
They know landscapes. So what you're seeing, not just in Yellowstone, which of course, you know, is full of wildlife. I didn't have a day at work where I wasn't stopped by a herd of something. Sometimes I couldn't get out of my office because elk were blocking the entrance. But even in Yosemite, you know, there are animals that, large and small, because connectivity is cut off, because there's that tension between private land and public land, they don't have the space they need to roam and grow and have genetic diversity, not any number of signs, especially here in California with the drought. That type of resilience that connectivity can provide to these wildlife is important. So I think we do need to scientifically stop thinking of these isolated islands for wildlife. And as I write about in my book, our neighborhoods need to be places that wildlife can also at least have the flexibility to move and survive, because the parks, again, are important. But, you know, the animals don't know park boundaries, and ecologically, park boundaries aren't, you know, going to do the job.
I wonder, David, whether in preserving wilderness, which we do in national parks, if there is a risk of then taming it or partially taming wilderness to sort of force animals to live by our rules.
Well, there is certainly. And And what Beth said, let me add one point to that. Some people might not realize there are no fences around our national parks. So when Beth says the animals don't see the boundaries, it's because there are no boundaries. You're in the middle of wilderness in forest on a mountainside or in a valley. And when you cross from Yellowstone Park into Shoshone National Forest, you don't see it, and the animals don't see it either. In terms of how we manage these areas to try and keep them wild or as a, quote, a vignette of the wild, it's tricky, and I call it in my book The Paradox of the Cultivated Wild.
Yeah.
Back in 1872, Congress drew a line on a map, created this rectangle, called it Yellowstone National Park, and implicit and to some degree explicit in that was the notion that we will now manage this rectangle of land to be a wild place with magnificent scenery and wildlife, and it will be different from what happens outside this rectangular boundary. But the very fact of saying we're going to manage it so that it will be wild is, if you think about it, paradoxical. How much should we manage it? How much should we let ecological processes determine what is there? And over the decades, we've learned that it's a very tricky, difficult thing to hit just the right balance between management and wildness. It's an ongoing dilemma.
Absolutely. Let me read a comment from Carol. She says she visited a national park. Sorry, the font is changing as I'm reading it. She visited a national park in Hawaii and had to write in to get access. There was a limit to 3 people. Picking up you, David, and also you, Beth, on just how to sort of manage people going in and out of parks. I don't know if 3 is, well, I don't know what that tells us exactly, but interesting. Beth, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, I think as American people, we're used to that, you know, things that are special or precious, that it may be that we, you know, need to make reservations. So I think, or buy a ticket. So I think it's something, again, I don't know how it would be implemented, and we don't want to limit access. We want to keep parks as for the people. But I think it is something to explore. And again, like I said, in Denali and Zion, they've tried it successfully. I do want to touch on, you know, with my wildlife background, just what David was saying. You know, one of the chapters in my book is on the Yosemite bears, which Yosemite has black bears. And to keep them wild, we do have to manage them because there are people on that landscape, people who are bringing food in their cars, which is, for a black bear who will eat anything and everything, can cause conflict. So, you know, we have this idea of this untouched wild, but I think, you know, even in national parks, we do have to manage them if we're going to have people and people activities in them. That doesn't mean it's a bad thing.
Right.
And this idea of wildlife without people, you know, one of the projects I work on, which is about as far from a national park as you can think, is in L.A., where we have, you know, the title of the book, where we have a mountain lion living among people for 4 years in the middle of the city. So it is this interesting balance. You don't want to make wildlife pets. You don't want to disturb the natural order of things. But in some respects, we already have, with climate change and again, our developments and having human activity in their spaces. So it is a tricky balance. I don't know how we'll get there, but I think we will.
And that's Beth Pratt Bergstrom. She's a California director for the National Wildlife Federation. We are talking about America's National Park Service celebrating its 100th anniversary tomorrow. Also with us is David Quammen, a well-known science writer, spent about 2 years actually exploring Yellowstone National Park to understand the grizzly bears and the habitat and the ecosystem there. Well, Jeremy Cronin fell in love with national parks when he was a teenager, and this past year he traveled the lower 48 and he visited 45 of the 47 national parks and blogged about it at chasingcairns.com. He's an outdoor educator. He is somewhere in America. I'm not exactly sure where, and joining us on Radio Times. And Jeremy Cronin, nice to have you on the show. And where are you?
I'm currently in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, on the side of the road somewhere?
In a parking lot, yeah.
In a parking lot, fair enough. Well, thank you for joining us. What got you thinking?
Of course, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. What got you thinking about a mission over the last year to visit all these national parks?
When I was a kid in 2003, I think my family did an extended road trip around the West, and it was kind of like my first introduction to that part of America and to many of the national parks. And so when I had an opportunity to recreate that and expand on that as an adult, I really wanted to jump on it so that I could better understand our relationships as Americans to wilderness and conservation and land ethic.
I'm curious.
That was kind of where it all came from.
Absolutely. And that's a kind of a theme that I'm hearing this hour. Jeremy, you went to 45 of the 47. Which two did you not get to?
I did not get to the Channel Islands right outside of L.A. because the waves were pushing 18 feet and the dock had washed away. So it was impossible for me to get there. And then I also did not get to Isle Royal, which is in the center of Lake Superior.
You wrote a piece in the New York Times recently about some of the things that you learned, but also some of the rules that you had for yourself. And I want to ask you, but also have our other guests weigh in on that. One of them is just slow down. And some of these parks, you know, the speed limit is 20, 25, maybe 30 miles an hour. And you stayed within the speed limit, Jeremy.
I did. I felt like there was no need to rush in national parks. And whether that means getting out and walking around or driving the post speed limit, take your time.
And what, when you take your time, this is such an obvious question, you get to see stuff, right?
Yeah, you're way more likely to see wildlife on the side of the road. You're way more likely to be looking around as opposed to focusing on the pair of headlights in front of you, or you're just more open to seeing the things around you.
David, you described in your story about spending all this time in Yellowstone, about 2 years, and you are a science writer, but just this notion of trying to slow yourself down to take in the environment, the animals, the experience.
Oh, absolutely, yes. That's very good advice. And as you say, I spent about 2 years researching this particular project for National Geographic, but I've lived in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem for about 30 years. So It's been a long process of becoming acquainted with this place. And as Jeremy says, slowing down as you drive, but also park, get out, walk. If you're in Yellowstone, for instance, and you walk 100 or 200 yards away from the road, you're in a completely different situation, a completely different atmosphere. You should definitely take the bear spray with you when you walk even that 100 or 200 yards. But get away from the road, and suddenly those 4 million people that are going through the park in the course of a summer, they're gone. Beth has talked about this too in Yosemite. Get off the road, get off the trail maybe, take your bear spray, and just a short distance from the pavement, you discover that this place still is very, very extraordinarily wild.
Jeremy, did you have any bear interactions?
Quite a few, actually. I was walking around in Yellowstone on my birthday, the end of my trip, and a park ranger was actually trying to divert a grizzly away from the hot springs area and was driving in a truck behind the grizzly bear and eventually steered the grizzly bear right at me. And eventually
wow.
Kind of steered it away from me, but that was kind of a surprising thing to see a running grizzly bear careening out of the woods coming at me.
And they are huge.
Yeah, this was about 1,000-pound grizzly.
One of the things, Beth, that Jeremy talks about is using real maps. I'm kind of a real map person, especially when I'm exploring a place that I'm not familiar with. But the idea of a paper map sort of giving you the big picture. Can you relate to that?
Yes, I love maps, and although I am a technology, love technology, I have my iPad, my iPhone, my iWatch, I carry quads, you know, the 7-minute or the park map. I think there's just something beautiful about maps, the texture, but also, you know, the connection to the land. And so I hike, although, you know, a lot of the routes I know by heart now, I think having that paper map that relates you directly, although, for technology, the maps on the iPad are great because you can track your journey and zoom in and out. One thing I do want to add to the slowdown is slow down also because it helps wildlife. In Yosemite, one of the threats to bears and other wildlife, and I had about 25 this year, were already hit by cars. So slowing down also helps the other creatures in the park who are trying to visit And getting out of your car, you will see more of them. I mean, we do see, like when I lived in Yellowstone in Yosemite, you see people just drive and stop. And as I said, you know, if you just get out of your car and slow down, you're going to experience the park and what it has to offer in such a different way.
Jeremy, I won't ask you your favorite park because I think that's really an unfair question, a question that really has no answer. But is there an experience, something that you feel like will stay with you for the rest of your life?
Oh, boy. Probably quite a few. But one of my favorite moments was I was camping on the dunes in Great Sand Dunes National Park. And I didn't realize that I needed to have a freestanding tent in order to camp on sand. So my tent blew over in the middle of the night, and I walked out under the Milky Way through this shifting sand landscape for about 2 to 3 hours. And I've never experienced anything like that. And it was really amazing.
And how about your companion, your car that you named Sam? How's Sam doing?
Sam is doing well. My drain plug fell out on my last little leg of this journey. But we are back on the road and good to go.
And this is a solo trip you took, right?
Yeah, I visited a lot of friends along the way. But the vast majority of the time I was traveling on my own.
And one of the things that you suggest or you did and found really fruitful was making sure that you talk to people.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to get a connection with a place if you don't have a connection with people who live in that place. So I really made a priority to talk to someone every day and to try to get a feel for what it was like to live in these places that I was just passing through by talking to them.
Well, Jeremy, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times, and good luck with the rest of your trip.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. That's Jeremy Cronin joining us from a parking lot somewhere in America. And he spent the last 10 months visiting almost every national park in the lower 48. And he chronicled his journey in his blog called ChasingCairns.com. And David Quammen staying with us for the rest of the hour. He's got a new book called Yellowstone, A Journey Through America's Wild Heart. Beth Pratt Bergstrom also has a book called When Mountain Lions Are Neighbors. And we are celebrating, we are marking the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and again, talking with David Quammen and Beth Pratt Bergstrom about our National Park Service, 100 years of the National Park Service. And let me read an email from David from Glenside. Beth, I'm going to put this to you. Shouldn't we be discouraging people from burning fuel and tramping through living places? Urging people to explore nature increases the self-entitlement that's been destroying life for thousands of years. It doesn't change animal and ecosystem abuse policy and practice. I know David, and this is a theme that he has, something that he cares deeply about. But there is, I guess, a question about, should we just leave nature alone and let it take care of itself? And do we hurt it by wanting to be close to it?
You know, I don't think we do. I think there's a balance, obviously, and, you know, a lot of human development does, you know, tip the balance into that we've destroyed it or paved over it. But, you know, we tend to think of, you know, a time where nature was not disturbed in human history, and I can't think of that. You know, in Yosemite, the Native Americans used to burn Yosemite Valley so that they could hunt and have sight lines and to manage the oaks and agriculture. So, you know, we can be balanced. And I think to not have a relationship with nature, to have it in these places that nobody visits, we have a connection to nature. We need a connection to nature and wildlife to be human. We are not separate from it. So I agree that it can be destructive, but it doesn't have to be. And I think in our national parks, they are great educational places to teach people how to be in nature and how to be a part of nature and how to maintain that balance even when they go home, and why it's important that natural spaces not be destroyed. But people, we are part of nature. I think it is very hard to separate ourselves from it. And indeed, it would do a disservice to both if we did.
David, let me ask you about something. You referenced this earlier in the hour, and this is really looking at the history of our National Park Service, but also just the history of large, wild, open areas. And there was a time when we, as a nation, or I guess maybe it was the military and others, decided to shoot what we would call bad animals at the time. These might be predators. And it sort of gets us into some of the thinking. Hopefully we don't think this way anymore. But the designation of bad animals and good animals. Can you speak to that?
Yes, definitely. That's part of the evolution that I talked about, the evolution of our thinking, of our ideas, of our perceptions of what the parks are for and how we deal with nature. And there was that perception early on from the founding of Yellowstone in 1872. There was this sense that, first of all, it was not founded as a wildlife refuge. It was founded as a destination to see scenic spectacles, the Grand Canyon of the Yellowstone River, the thermal features, the geysers, etc., the Great Falls of the Yellowstone River. And gradually it evolved into a wildlife refuge. But as it did that, our ideas about wildlife changed. Even Teddy Roosevelt, a great, great conservationist, was a man of his time in the sense that he thought of good animals and bad animals. His ideas evolved too, but early on at least, there were the good animals, and those generally were the herbivores, the elk and the bison and the deer and the creatures that ate vegetation. And then there were the bad animals, the predators, that preyed on the good animals. And so there was systematic effort to eradicate or reduce the populations of wolves,
coyotes,
mountain lions, to bears to a lesser extent because bears are omnivores, but even pelicans, white pelicans, native to Yellowstone National Park, nesting on islands in Yellowstone Lake, were persecuted during the 1920s and 30s by park policy because pelicans eat trout, and trout were considered good animals. People wanted to come and catch them, and therefore it was thought we should reduce the bad animals, crushing pelican eggs in their nests, so there would be less predation pressure on the trout. Huh. It was crazy, and eventually, thank goodness, we got away from that and realized that all of the native animals of this ecosystem are good animals in one sense or another.
Let me get Drew from Chestnut Hill to join our conversation. Hi, Drew. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thanks. So a few times you've made reference to some sort of peripheral type entities because on my research it seems like there's around 60 actual parks and a void of them in sort of the northeast corridor here around Philadelphia. So I was just curious if you knew of a resource or can make some recommendations of finding those sort of peripheral type experiences that you alluded to a few times.
Yeah, I mean, the National Park Service includes the parks. These are also monuments, as they're called. Independence National Historical Park, just down the street from us, is part of the National Park Service. I'm sure if you go to their website, they can direct you in all different directions. Anything, David, you want to add to that, or Beth?
I would add, yes, that there are something like 400 sites that are now within the jurisdiction managed by the National Park Service. And as you said, not just national parks, national monuments, national historic sites, but some other entities. For instance, Edmund Pettus Bridge, the iconic site from the Civil Rights Movement, is managed by the National Park Service. Stonewall Inn in New York, one of the landmark places in the rise of gay rights. Activism is within the management of the National Park Service and a number of others that have important historical value, although they might not have great biological diversity.
Beth, you...
Go ahead. I was just going to say there's a great... the National Park Service website is great, and then the National Park Foundation has been doing a Find Your Park this year where you can go to their website and you can browse by state or search by experience because, yeah, we tend to think of the national parks as these iconics, but I love how David mentioned they are not just... And there's actually... the 40 are sort of the big ones, but there's all these other sites managed by them that, again, these places online can tell you by state, and you'd be surprised at how many national parks are in your state.
Well, let me pick up on something. Again, you have both referenced, but this what climate change is doing to some of these national parks. And David, you spent a couple of years, I mean, you know Yellowstone so well. Can you see the impact of climate change in Yellowstone itself?
Yes, we certainly can. I mean, it's one of those things that's hard to measure because ecological effects are always hard to measure. But at least there is very, very strong inference that the climate of Yellowstone has been changing, and there are consequences over the long term for the wildlife there. For one instance, one of the four traditionally major foods of grizzly bears within the Yellowstone ecosystem are white bark pine nuts. It's a highly nutritious, fatty pine seed that is in the cones of these white bark pines that grow at high elevations around 8,500 feet and above, and grizzly bears feed on them in the fall. Squirrels gather them into middens, and the grizzly bears raid the middens and get these highly nutritious pine seeds. But the white bark pines in Yellowstone have been dying off over the last 13, 15, 20 years because of a couple of effects. One is a native beetle, a pine beetle that bores into their through their bark and cuts off their circulation and kills them, and an exotic fungus. Now, both the native beetle and the exotic fungus seem to have been exacerbated by climate change. The beetle has always been there, but now in the area where there are fewer severe cold snaps, weeks of sub-sub-zero weather in the early winter and in the early spring, fewer of those cold snaps means that the beetles' populations are not being knocked down, and they're severely reducing the white bark pine upon which the grizzly feeds.
So you can see the kind of unintended consequences of that. How about for you, Beth, when you look at Yosemite? Do you see the effects of climate change? I hear that in your voice.
California, yeah. My backyard, we just had to have 5 trees removed. There are 60 million trees dying in the Sierra Nevada as a result of this severe drought, which most agree is unprecedented because of climate change. So you have a park. And what we're finding, we have the opposite problem here, where the snowpack is the water bank for California, and also the health of the snowpack, you know, is what creatures in the park depends on to be a healthy ecosystem. And we're getting less snow, which then, you know, California runs out of water in the summer. Unlike the East Coast where I grew up, it doesn't rain here from May to October. So
amazing.
If you don't have a good snowbank, water doesn't come out of the tap. So, and also my wedding that I got married 2 years ago in Yosemite almost had to be canceled because of forest fire. I've had to evacuate my house a couple times. We've had, I think last year, 6 major fires around my place near the park. So we are seeing it and living it day to day here.
David, let me go back to you and the piece that you wrote. And you write about a man, this was last summer, a guy named Lance Crosby was killed by a grizzly bear, partially eaten by this bear, perhaps even the cubs eating this person as well. What's the message of this obviously tragic story?
Well, one of the messages is that grizzly bears can be very dangerous animals, and they need to be respected. When you hike in Yellowstone, you need, as I mentioned earlier, you need to take precautions for your own sake and also for the sake of the bears. If they kill you and eat you, they will be in trouble. In some cases, that means the execution of a bear. Not in every case. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on whether it seems to have been an act of intentional predation on a human victim, or whether it was just a very, very unfortunate encounter. So that decision always has to be made by the park managers. But the other thing worth remembering is that these human deaths attributable to grizzlies are very dramatic, and they get a lot of attention. But there have only been something like, I think it's seven grizzly-caused human deaths in the last 100 years in Yellowstone National Park. More people have died of drowning. More people have died of suicide in Yellowstone National Park than have died of grizzly bears. So it happens, but it's uncommon, and it can be prevented if people do what they need to do.
Do you think it's correct to execute a grizzly bear for killing somebody?
Well, It depends on the circumstances. I mean, it's always a controversial, unpopular thing. But the Park Service has a responsibility not just to protect the wildlife, but to protect the people who come. And I know the people who have to make that decision. They do it very reluctantly. If a grizzly bear has encountered a human and the human was not taking responsibility for his or her own actions, and it was just an unfortunate encounter, and the human got killed, generally the grizzly bear will be spared. But if humans allow a grizzly to become habituated to the idea that it can prey upon humans, it can eat human food, and it can even eat human flesh, if we humans allow grizzly bears to become acclimated to that, then that's going to be a death sentence for that grizzly bear.
Let me read a comment from Chris. I'll try to summarize this. In 1991, our family, ranging in ages from 4 to 14, drove across country from Philly to as far west as Salt Lake City, visiting many national parks, Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, Cedar Breaks, Petrified Forest, Sunset Crater, Grand Teton, Zion, and the Badlands. Since then, I've added at least another dozen parks to my history. Yosemite is on my bucket list. The parks are such a treasure, I would have no issue with limited access, similar to the way Independence National Park requires pre-booking. Also, a tweet that we had, and I'll put this to you, Beth, about whether Congress does enough to support the parks and ensure that they survive the next 100 years.
Yeah, I saw that tweet as well. And, you know, I have worked in the national park system most of my career. I know the park rangers, the staff, and, you know, the parks I've worked in and others, they work extremely hard. But, yes, they don't have the resources they need to do their job, whether it be from staffing levels, which I know have gone down. When I used to, you know, I've hiked the Muir Trail. I've hiked extensively in, you know, Yellowstone and other parks. You used to see rangers on the trail. They don't have the budget. The infrastructure, you know, the maintenance backlog in these parks, I think that we do need to be allocating more money from our budget for these national treasures, and that it needs to be a value that, you know, we put our money where our mouth is. These parks, as we say, are get enormous amounts of visitors. And, you know, as we know, any other tourist destination, that requires resources. So let's give the parks the money they need to do their jobs.
Any argument there, David? No, go ahead.
No. Yeah, I'd love to add to that what Beth said. It's worth being aware, too, that that public money doesn't entirely support these national parks, even though they are public institutions.
Exactly.
There are private foundations that take in private donations from people who want to help support these great public institutions. There's a Yellowstone National Park Foundation. There's a Grand Teton National Park Foundation. Beth, I'm sure there's an equivalent for Yosemite. Private organizations that help to support.
Yeah, go ahead, David. No, go ahead.
So these private organizations that help to support these public institutions, and that itself is a wonderful thing, but it's a reminder that that the parks deserve more public support too.
David, have you thought about the next 100 years, what our National Park Service might look like?
Unfortunately, or fortunately, that I don't have to do that. John Jarvis and others who run the National Park Service are thinking about that. I know that one of the things they're thinking about is not expansion of visitor numbers. That probably can't be done because the quantity of resources isn't there, but expanding the diversity. They realize it's hugely important to expand the diversity of visitors to Yellowstone. We need to get these places more attractive to, accessible to, appreciated by people from the cities, people of color, people of all ethnic backgrounds. We need to get these doors open so that kids in urban areas in the East can have the opportunity of seeing a bison or a grizzly bear in Yellowstone National Park.
Well, you two have gotten us all excited. Thank you so much, David Quammen. Thank you for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Marty, thank you very much for letting me think about this with you.
Oh, absolutely. And he's a well-known science writer. He's got a new book called Yellowstone, A Journey Through America's Wild Heart. And Beth Pratt-Bergstrom, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you. Hey, driving to all the national parks in California, I often listen to your show out here, so
oh,
thanks
excellent.
For having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome. She's California director for the National Wildlife Federation, and she wrote a book called When Mountain Lions Are Neighbors. And we also spoke with Jeremy Cronin, who has spent the last 10 months or so visiting just about all of the national parks in the lower 48. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. Check us out on Facebook. I put a picture of my son climbing in arches 25 years ago. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.